The title I gave to this talk is The Wilderness of Doubt and the Shackles of Craving. This actually comes straight from the Saitokila Sutta. Please excuse my Pali pronunciation. From the Majjhima Nikaya. And so I'm going to read sections of this and talk about it. At the beginning says, bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has not abandoned the five wildernesses in the heart and not severed the five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline that is impossible. So here's the Buddha sort of another laying out yet another list. I was fascinated by this because I was the list I wasn't familiar with when I started reading and studying this particular sutta. I said, oh, a new list. And he says basically if you don't deal with this stuff, you can't progress in the practice. Okay. And then he goes on and says, what bhikkhus are the five wildernesses in the heart and he has not abandoned? Here a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the teacher. And thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, that is the first wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. And then he goes on and he lists the other four that were having doubt in the Dhamma, having doubt in the Sangha, having doubt in the training, the actual form of the practice, and doubt in companions. So I want to look first at the word wilderness. Because in our Boulder, Colorado world, wilderness is like, oh boy, it's the wilderness, you know. We get to go into the wilderness and hike and climb, and it's like a really good thing, wilderness, right? 2,500 years ago in North India, wilderness was like a dangerous place, basically. It was like something that got in the way of getting from one place to another. You had to cross this wilderness. And interestingly enough, in the dictionary, when you look up wilderness, it says a neglected or abandoned area. So which is, once again, not the sense of wilderness that we have when we think wilderness in our Colorado minds. It's not so nice, a neglected or abandoned area, right? And in the direct translation of the Pali, the word translated as wilderness, it has the sense of rigidity of mind, of rubbish, of a stump that's in the way, something that blocks progress. So wilderness is not a good thing. I wanted to make, sort of translate that into our, translate our normal thinking on the word wilderness here to what was intended in the sutta. And all of these have to do with doubt, which is one of the five kalesas. And of all the kalesas, by far the most difficult to work with. In the classical similes about doubt, it's a pond that's all, it's scummy, but also the water is very turbid and cloudy. You can't see at all. Everything is totally unclear. And that's the sense of what he's talking about here when he talks about the problem of this, is that, and why we have to abandon this. We have to abandon these wildernesses. Because if we don't abandon them, we'll never see clearly. Okay, so then let's look at the teacher, at the list here. The first was the teacher. And this now, in the sense it was written when the Buddha was speaking this, this of course meant him. He was the teacher. And if you doubt the teacher, then it's very difficult. If you don't, it's like, I don't make a connection with this person who's teaching. I doubt them. I don't think they're legit. It's very difficult to go forward, to as he says, to persevere, because it's like, oh, I'm even this person. I don't know about this person. And you know, this is true now today in our more liberal, broad word, the word teacher. I mean, I'm even included there, right? So, to doubt the teacher means you're going to start doubting everything the teacher says, which means you're not going to, if you're going to a teacher, it's because you want to be taught something. But if you doubt the teacher, then, you know, then you're not going to get much, right? It's at the same time, and I want to be very precise here, the Buddha was very, very clear that he strongly approved of people questioning everything. And questioning is, in a sense, different from doubt. Questioning is like, I've suspended my disbelief, but I need more information. I need to understand this for myself. Whereas doubt is, nah, this is nonsense. It's a different flavor. Okay, so he really encouraged people. There's a famous sutta of the Kalamas where he's talking to these guys, and he goes through this long list of things they shouldn't believe in when they were trying to figure out what was right and what was wrong. And at the very end, he says, and don't believe, basically what he says, and don't believe a word I say. So it's important that we have that kind of, I need to understand this for myself before it becomes really true for me. I mean, I don't doubt that what the teacher's saying is what the teacher believes is true and that the teacher's experience is valid, but I still need to understand it for myself. It's a different flavor of that word, I guess. And then the next one is doubting the Dhamma. So the teacher's fine, but these teachings, I don't know. And they just don't make any sense to me. They don't seem to be, you know, what I understand. And it's not, or often here in Boulder, it's like, it's not what that other teacher told me last week, you know, because there's so many different ways of teaching. And the Buddha's teachings are like a roadmap, you know, that he figured out over, you know, 50 years of diligent practice, you know, including 40 years after he was enlightened. He still was practicing for 40 years after that. And he laid out this very precise map. And the beauty of the map, of course, is, well, you can go take this road, or you can, you know, go this back way through the canyon, or you can go all the way around and through the desert. But there's lots of different ways you can get there. So it's not like there's like only this one way. The roadmap is quite open, but it's all there, and it's very precise in the sense of, well, if you follow this map, you'll get where you want to go. And basically, if we've undertaken this practice, then we should follow the map. And if we don't follow the map, how will we possibly even know we're heading in the right direction? We can't. We can't possibly know we're heading in. We don't follow the map. Or if the road sign says go that way, and we say, oh, no, I think I'll go this way instead. Guess what's going to happen? It's not going to work. So we have to not doubt the Dhamma. Once again, investigate it. See what's true for you. What becomes truer and truer based on your experience and your intuition, your insight. But if you doubt it at the start, you're never going to get anywhere. And the third one, doubting the Sangha. And this, I think, has two quite distinct meanings. The first of these is doubting the importance of Sangha. And I've spoken to, it's amazing the number of people I talk to sometimes who say, oh yeah, I'm a Buddhist, but I don't like Sanghas. I'm just like, huh? It's like, the Sangha is what supports us. The Sangha is what gives us energy. The Sangha is like critical to the teachings, to the practice. Without Sangha, it's like, you know, it's that,
a man's got to do what a man's got to do, and I'm tough and I can do it on my own sort of vibe very quickly turns into that, right? And that's dangerous, because there's no one there to go, gee, Barry, are you sure that's the way you want to do this? there's no correction going on. You're just sort of, I'm tough and I'm going to do this on my own. And yeah, that's possible. The Buddha did it. But then he taught for 40 years and laid out all this great roadmap and said, hang out with the Sangha. In fact, there's a really interesting sutta that I like to mention at this point, talking about Sangha. And this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is the Venerable Ananda. So the Ananda is the Buddha's servant, the person who took care of the Buddha for many, many years and was very close to the Buddha. So then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. Not so, Ananda. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the noble eightfold path. Wow. It's like, this is like important that we have Sangha. It's the whole thing. Or one view of the whole thing, at least. I shouldn't say it's the whole thing, but it's one view of the whole thing. So that's one way we can take this doubting the Sangha. The other way is where we can get caught in comparing. We don't doubt the Sangha as a whole, but we doubt individuals in the Sangha. Oh, they're not really that sincere. They're not serious enough. Blah, 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 blah. And we get caught in that whole judging, comparing mind space. That always leads to contention in our minds, and often can lead to contention in a more direct sense. So it's something we have to really watch for. This is often also a sign of pride, of feeling I know better than these other people who aren't so advanced, So that's where our mind goes if we're not careful. Very quickly we can go there. And so that's another way of doubting the Sangha. Now, I just want to mention one thing. So here we are, the first three, we're doubting the teacher, doubting the Dhamma, doubting the Sangha. Oh, wait, that's the three refuges. We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. So we're doubting the refuges. That these things are refuges when we doubt these three. So, and that is a problem, of course. Then we doubting the training. This is interesting. And once again, this has a particular context because he was, you know, in this sutta speaking to monastics, where the training was quite strict. I mean, the Vinaya was like this huge, long list of things they should do and shouldn't do, from like how they should tie their robe to when they could eat and when they could do this and when they could do that, and how, you know, they couldn't store food, they couldn't carry food more than 5 leagues or whatever that some distance was. They couldn't do this, they couldn't touch money. It was a very strict set of practices. All of them aimed at making sure that the monastics didn't turn into social butterflies and hang out with all these other people. They just hung out with other monastics who were in the same situation they were, number one. And number two, that they led these really simple, simple lives. I mean, basically, you know, the monastics had the four requisites, you know, a robe, a bowl, a walking staff. They were entitled to a hut that some villager helped them put up, and they were entitled to medicines that the villagers would supply if they were sick. That was it. That's all they ever got. It was, and so doubting this was sort of like, oh, well, you know, I don't really have to only eat once a day. Or I only, you know, we start to bend the rules. And in householder life, which is what we're all householders, right? It's the same thing. We can very quickly start doubting that this particular form or practice that we've taken on, and I'm assuming all of us have a particular form or practice, that we start to doubt that it's any good, that it makes sense, that doing the practice this way is good. And once again, we shouldn't hesitate to question, but if you doubt the practice, you're not going to put a lot of energy into it. It's not going to be something you want to do. It's not going to be something that you know, gets you going, because it's going to be like, oh God, it's the same old practice, same old, nothing ever happens, blah, 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 blah. We get caught in that world of doubt about whether the practice is effective or the right one for me. You know, maybe I should really be practicing Zen, or, you know, maybe I should become a Sufi and take up, you know, they sing and they dance, they have this nice time all the time. I should be a Sufi. You know, it's pretty easy for the mind to go all these other places. And that's all about doubting the practice itself. And we just won't be very diligent in our practice if we doubt the practice. And finally, the fifth one on this list, doubting the companions. This actually, it sort of sounds like doubting the Sangha, but it has a different flavor. Actually, when you read it in the sutta here, again, a bhikkhu is angry and displeased with his companions in the holy life, resentful and callous towards them, and thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. So this is more like, you know, dissing your companions in the Sangha, not being very nice, being rude, being angry, displeased, resentful, and callous. These are not wholesome states of mind. So this isn't doubt per se, as so much as just being an ordinary son of a, you know what I mean. And this is more ill will than doubt. This ill will arising because, you know, that guy always gets the best hut. That guy always gets more food when we do the rounds. Now, some of the people in the village just give him more than they give me. Blah, 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 blah. You know, that's the energy that the Buddha is talking about here. That sort of resentful grinding in the mind, which instead of having loving kindness and compassion and, oh, look, that person gets more than me. Isn't that great? I'm so happy for them. You know, no mudita. The opposite of all those, the Brahma Viharas is what we're talking about here. And so these five together are all wildernesses. In wildernesses, we can sort of get lost in the wilderness, right? That's another good idea for the term for the word wilderness. It's a place you can get lost in. And it's like when you're lost in the wilderness, you can't figure out how the heck do I get out of here? I really got myself in a mess. And when I've been in deep doubt times, that's how I felt, like, oh, I'm just stuck here. This is horrible. Oh my God. And the Buddha basically says you have to abandon these wildernesses. You know, completely give them up. And this takes, of course, mindfulness. And that's why we practice mindfulness. We can start to see, oh, here I am stuck in one of my favorite wildernesses again. and the mindfulness catches that, and then we say, oh, I don't need to be here. I can abandon this. I can go to a state of goodwill instead of ill will in this place. I can shift the course of my mind. And that's what mindfulness and the Brahma Viharas allow us to do. So then we have the five shackles in the heart. Here we are. And the list here. What, bhikkhus, are the five shackles in the heart? Here, bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, and craving for sensual pleasures. And thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, that is the first shackle in the heart. And then he lists the other ones besides sensual pleasure, craving for maintaining a body, craving for form, craving for eating and napping. Don't we all do that? And desiring a godlike form, which I think is a great one. We'll put that into contemporary language, these into contemporary language. Oops. So I want to start by talking about the first one, craving for sensual pleasure, which I almost feel like I don't need to talk about it to you guys, but I can't ignore it. And actually, I found this really great passage in the Experience of Insight. Joseph Goldstein's first book that I want to share with you. And he's talking about sensual pleasure as something that shackles the heart. Now, shackles is another interesting word. You don't hear it too often. So I just watched Cool Hand Luke last night, and he got shackled. So that is very contemporary for me at the moment. A shackle. Fetters connected together by a chain used to fasten a prisoner's wrists or ankles together. You're constricted. In the actual translation of the Pali, there's also this energy, this sense of clenching the mind like a fist, like it's a tightness to craving. And I also want to make sure you understand that we're not talking about desire in the broad sense of the word, because
Desire is a pretty neutral thing, actually. I mean, you all had a desire to come here tonight. This was a wholesome desire, hopefully. We have to be careful. You know, the Pali word tanha is often translated desire, but it's really talking about craving. In fact, I mean, he uses these words here, lust, thirst, fever, craving. These are all like, it's gone past the desire to I gotta have it, and I gotta have it right now. Craving is a strong, uncontrollable desire. It's a different level of energy. And Joseph's talking with this is lusting after sense pleasure, grasping at sense objects. It keeps the mind looking outward, searching after this object or that in an agitated and unbalanced way. It is the very nature of sense desires that they can never be satisfied. There is no end to seeking. We enjoy a pleasurable object. It arises and disappears, as do all phenomena, and we are left with the same unsatiated desire for more gratification. Until we deal with that kind of grasping in the mind, we remain always unfulfilled, always seeking a new pleasure, a new delight. It can be desire for beautiful sights, beautiful sounds, tastes or smells, beautiful sensations in the body, or fascinating ideas. There's one for our culture, right? Attachment to these objects strengthens the greed factor, and it is precisely the greed in the mind, this clinging and grasping, which keeps us bound. There's the sense of shackles again in Joseph's language, bound with shackles. So this is more just like, we actually have to see this. We have to understand this, because if we don't understand it, then we just keep repeating this cycle over and over again of thinking somehow satisfying that next sense desire, that's what's going to do it for me. And at the same time, I want to also make really clear, it's perfectly all right to enjoy sensual things. Good food, companionship, all those sorts of things. There's nothing wrong or bad about them. It's when they turn into a craving for them. It goes from, gee, that was nice, to I got to have it, and I got to have it right now. It's the energy behind the process that's important here. Then we got craving for maintaining a body. This is one's own body. And we somehow get caught in thinking that this body, this special body right here, is somehow exempt from the rules that are true of all bodies. Like that somehow this body isn't going to get old, get sick, and die. But it is. And we just, we can't, we want to not believe that. And our culture certainly is centered around not believing that, and in fact, in encouraging us not to believe that. You know, the whole beauty business is based on this premise. The whole fashion business, and on and on and on and on. I mean, the whole advertising business, right? I mean, it's all about, if you get this, you'll be cool, sexy, beautiful, hip, you name it. And if the ad doesn't say that quite clearly, it's not a very good ad. I used to be in marketing at one time, so I've been around this stuff a little bit. And it's just, so that's one level we're talking about here.
But there's another whole level, and that's like that idea that somehow when this body ends, my soul, I'm still going to be around. I'm just going to have a new form. This body, this personality, which is really how I think of my body a lot of the time, my body is just part of my personality, is going to continue beyond the end when death comes. And that's not true either. It's just not true. But we cling to that idea, and think of most traditional religious forms have that as a central tenet of the teaching. It's clinging to the body. That's what that's all about. I'm going to continue. If I do this right, I'm going to go to heaven, and then when the trumpets sound, I'm going to rise up with all those other people who are pure and virtuous, and be back in this body again, and it'll be in this paradise. Sorry. You know, that's called clinging, craving for a body. And this is, I don't want to sort of make this sound like, oh, well, this is, we can break this shackle really easy. This is deeply, deeply inbred. It's sort of almost, part of it is like physical, like how we're wired. You know, we're wired to preserve this body. That's part of how our mental makeup. And like I said, we also don't want to actually believe that things are going to change. I'll give you a personal example of how I worked. I discovered this because these are things that we have to see at some deeper. I mean, I can talk about it, and you can nod, and we can all believe this what I'm saying. But unless we have a deep intuitive understanding of it, it really doesn't really sink in. So this is I was on one of my retreat stories. And I was on retreat, and I was had the duty to ring the bell before the 2:30 sit or something like that. I think it was around that, sometime in mid-afternoon. And this is like, you know, you take on this as a sort of responsibility to help the functioning of the Sangha, right? So I took it quite seriously. And I was, at this point, it was fairly late in the retreat, about 3 weeks in. I was quite in one of those periods where I was quite concentrated and very mindful and very precise. And so I walked very carefully to the bell, and I took this big clanger thing that you hit the bell with. And I could feel my arms swinging in the air, and I could feel the clanger hit the bell, and I could hear the sound of the bell and feel the vibration in my, I was really like tuned into what was going on. And I, you know, clanged the thing 6 or 7 times, as we, you know, made a really nice loud clang. And then I hung up the thing on the hook by the bell. And just as I started to walk away, in my mind, this thought said, you may never ring that bell again. And it was like, oh, there was like this pause. And then my mind immediately went to, no, there's still 3 days left in the retreat. You'll be here. You'll be ringing the bell tomorrow. And then it was like, oh, I may never ring that bell again. You know, I had sort of decided that, yeah, I really believed in this idea that this body wasn't permanent, but not for another 20 years or so. As opposed to, well, who knows? We don't know. We don't know. And that was like, oh, that's what they're talking about. And that was just clinging to this body, craving a body to keep this body. Okay. Then the next one is interesting, because the craving to form. And I had to sort of think about this and actually look in the commentaries on this sutta in another place. This is craving for other bodies. Not my body. I want that other body. And this has, you know, some sense of sensuality attached to it, but it's much broader than that. You know, I want that other body that I really like to be permanent. I don't want that body to go away. Just like I don't want this body to go away, I don't want that body to go away either. I'm craving for that form to be permanent. I'm making something permanent that isn't. That's what craving for form does. And whether that's another body or it's my new car, it's the same craving. It's just wanting to, making things permanent because I don't want them to go away. Another smaller way, I think, is just, you know, when you're craving for form, is like craving for interesting things to look at, which could be other bodies, but it could be art. I'm a painter, so I have this sort of thing where I love to look at art. And it's like, I sometimes crave it, like, oh, I wish I could just go to a great museum and go look at art for a couple hours. You know, it's like a craving sometimes. I have these fantasies of going to Spain and hanging out in the Prado for a couple of days, you know. But that's just craving for form in the broader sense, having that sensual connection to another form, whether it's a body or an object of some sort, doesn't say it's the same idea. Then the next one, I think I don't actually want to read. Again, a bhikkhu eats as much as he likes until his belly is full and indulges in the pleasures of sleeping, lolling, and drowsing. It's talking about laziness or sloth and torpor, as it says when we're talking about this as a kalesa. You know, this is like, it's so tempting sometimes. Oh, I think I'll just take a day off and just put my feet up and read this book, and maybe I'll have a snack while I'm reading the book. It's so easy to go, and I'm not saying any of that is bad. Sometimes that's exactly what we need to do. You know, we've had a really tough day, the things are going kind of crazy. I need to sort of mellow out. Then reading a good book and having a snack might be exactly what you need to do. But when it becomes a habit, when it becomes something I have to do, I need to do this right now, even though, you know, actually I can't because I got to deal with the rest of my life. But I got to, that's the craving to sort of space out, I think might be a good, you know, a good contemporary word for this. Craving for spacing out. Just like kicking back and not paying much attention, not being mindful in the least. Just anyhow, enough said about that. And you all understand what I'm talking about here. And then there's this last one. Again, a bhikkhu lives the holy life, aspiring as some order of gods. Thus, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god. This is 2,500 years ago talk for, I want to be famous. I want my 15 minutes of fame, please. Yeah. And this is a fascinating one for me, because I've certainly, especially on retreat, had experiences of exactly this. You know, imagining myself on America's Got Talent as a great blues singer. Really. I mean, I spent a lot of time figuring out how I could make this happen, you know. Just, and it's just like the mind goes to these places of just wanting, I want to be not just this guy. You know, I want to be something more than just this. I want to be, you know, a famous Dharma teacher or a famous blues singer or a famous artist or a famous, who knows. But our mind goes there because it's so attractive to be, have a godlike form, you know. And that was the language of the time. But in our culture, that somehow we deserve our 15 minutes of fame. We're all owed that somehow. You know? Well, if everybody had 50 minutes of fame, would run out of minutes in the day pretty quickly, or minutes in a year for that matter. 7 billion people having 50 minutes of fame would be pretty crazy. So once again, so, and here, remember that what the Buddha said here is that we have to abandon the wildernesses of doubt and sever the shackles of craving. It's different energy. Abandoning is sort of walking away from them in a way, pushing away. Severing is like, nope, not going to do that. It's like chopping the shackles, like breaking them. It's a different sort of vibe, in a sense. Okay. And then the Sutta goes to this really interesting place. Then the Buddha says, bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu who has abandoned these five wildernesses in the heart and severed these five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this dharma and discipline that is possible. It doesn't say it's certain. He says it's possible. So it's like, okay, let's, you know, get rid of all these doubts. Let's, you know, break all these shackles of craving. And then let's get serious. And then he makes another list of five more things. Oh no, five more. He develops a basis for spiritual power consisting in the concentration due to zeal and determined striving. And then he lists these others. Four. So he's talking about developing concentration. Part of the Eightfold Path, right? Developing concentration by zeal, by energy, effort, right? Effort, right? Purity of mind, investigation. This is a tricky word because in our language that means thinking about, whereas actually in Pali and in the translations of investigation is more implying being open to things arising that are intuitive and insightful. And sometimes that requires dropping little questions into the mind as you're practicing. If this is quite an interesting thing to do, if you're sort of in a state of mind, whether it's a wholesome one or an unwholesome one, you feel like you're sort of just cruising on cruise control in your practice at a certain point, it's very skillful to pause the noting of what's arising and just drop a little question into the mind along the lines of, what's happening now? Not expecting an answer, like in the intellectual sense, but just sort of like dropping that question into the mind sometimes sort of snaps us out of cruise control into more precise attention. Or it takes us away from the layer of content of mind into the layer of process of mind, which is where investigation should lead. We want to investigate not what's acting, you know, the stuff that's coming up in our mind, all that stuff, just one thing after another, but what's the underlying process? You know, can we see, really see impermanence? Can really, really see unsatisfactoriness and not self? Not as intellectual constructs, but as things we're actually experiencing, which are the substratum underneath the content of mind. That's when he says in investigation, that's what he's talking about. Investigating at that level. Looking underneath the surface layer of content. And the last of these is enthusiasm. Oh boy, isn't this great? We have to be able to actually say that when we're practicing, like, oh, this is so cool. Get excited about the fact that we're practicing. This list, zeal, energy, purity of mind, investigation, and enthusiasm, parallels the beginnings of the factors of awakening, the first four. So this is the energetic factors of awakening. It's expressed in different words, but that's what he's talking about. This is like, once we've got out of the wilderness and broken the shackles, now we're ready to actually put energy, enthusiasm, zeal, investigation, put all these energetic things into process. Because that's when these intuitive insights will really start to arise. It isn't just enough to be a good person. That's another way we could put this. It's very important that we're a good person. You know? But it's not enough. We can be a good person, but then we have to actually have to really practice enthusiastically, with zeal, with enthusiasm, with purity of mind. Investigate. Look at things more closely. That's when, according to the Buddha, a bhikkhu who possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. So, in a sense, this is the key, this last list of five. You know, the first ones are things we understand, and I can work on those things. And then it's like, oh, and now I have to do this too. I have to put energy into this practice, a lot of energy into this practice, as well as just being this good person, which is important. Then there's this, at the end, there's this really interesting image at the end of the sutta. Suppose there were a hen with 8, 10, or 12 eggs, which she had covered, incubated, and nurtured properly. Even though she did not wish, oh, that my chicks might pierce their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatch out safely, yet the chicks are capable of piercing their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatching out safely. So too, a bhikkhu who possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out. So he's saying, yeah, you know, the chickens laid these eggs and has sat on them and incubated them. But in the end, that's all the chicken can do. The chicks have to actually break out of their shells, using their claws and their beaks. This is pretty fierce, themselves. We're the chicks. We have to break out of our shells ourselves. No one can make us do it. No one can make us, someone can't come along and break the shell and let us out. If you do that, typically whatever's in there dies right away. They have to do it on their own. just like we have to do it on our own. It's a great image, and we have to break out of our own shells. And we have to do it. It's a little fierceness there with our claws and beaks, you know, pecking away, forcing our way out. It's energetic. I like the image. No one else can do this for us. No one else can get us, break us out. We have to do it ourselves. That's the final message in the sutta. So that's the wildernesses of doubt and the shackles of craving. I discovered this sutta a while ago, and I thought, oh, this would. At first, I was like, oh my God, not another list. But then I went, oh, this is really it approaches things from a different way. It's like it's good to look at the teachings from a different angle, in a sense, which is what I think this sutta does. And I find it encouraging to look at things from different angles. Anyhow, that's all I have to say. And so at this point, as usual, I will say, does anyone have anything they would like to say? Any questions or comments or thoughts? So Deborah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm glad you picked this sutta because it's really come at a important time for me because I've been experiencing all these things. You know, and I was blaming it on the pandemic and, you know, I'm just tired of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm ready to be done with it. But thank you. It was helpful.
Good. It's interesting. I see this all the time myself. A Dharma talk, sometimes you hear a Dharma talk and you go, oh, that was nice. But sometimes you hear a Dharma talk and it's like, it just sort of hits you. It's like if someone was speaking directly to you, even though there might be a room like 90 people in the room, that teacher is talking straight to you. That's how mm-hmm. Dharma talks work. Sometimes they just are the perfect thing you need to hear at that moment. I'm glad it was good for you today. Other thoughts, comments, questions? Oh, Carolyn's got something to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, I had a really similar experience to Deborah in that I've been experiencing a lot of doubt, just not really and not really any concrete reason, but just doubting everything in my life, everything at work, everyone around me, like just doubt. And it doesn't feel very good, but it's like a wave that kind of came over me recently. It's interesting to hear this talk, and I'm just thinking about how to work skillfully with waves of doubt. So,
yeah, that it said that the best antidote to doubt is to keep going back and remembering your original intention for doing the practice in the first place. That and study are the two normal antidotes to doubt. Going back and reaffirming your original intention and studying more, going deeper into the study and understanding the teachings. Those are the two things that break doubt. Anything else? Okay. I, of course, have a poem I have to read. This has a sense of the breaking out of the shell. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And the title of the poem is Lay the Armor Down. Arriving back from the fields of battle, bruised and bolder, we are beholden to no one now. Losing or winning, the reasons for the war fade quickly in the memory. We've forgotten that these suits of armor are not our second skins. Smiling, we set aside the shields and swords, remove the face masks, begin to peel away the layers of weight and protection. When finally we cast our armor to the ground, it feels as if our bodies grow and straighten, swell and lengthen upwards towards the sun. We run, light and unencumbered,
and stretch the stiffness from our joints. Rolling on the grass, we laugh as awkward limbs remember freedom. When at last we return to where we started, without a second glance, we know that we've outgrown the suits of armor. We won't fit inside those too tight shells again. Why would we even try? It's good advice from Dana Falls. So let's just dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for joining me.
Larry, I have a question. What's the format of the day-long retreat going to be?
What's the format? As in like schedule or just what am I going to do?
Yeah.
So this is the day-long retreat I'm teaching on Sunday, by the way, for anybody who's wondering what serious questions about. We start at 9 and basically we have cycles where I teach, we practice sitting, we do some walking practice, we come back, and then I teach some more, and then we sit, and then we do some more walking practice. And at some point we stop after a sit and have some lunch, and we take a break and people go outside and go for a walk and do whatever it is they do on their, have a nap, do some yoga, do some Tai Chi, whatever. And then we keep going through that cycle. I teach, we sit, we do some walking practice. And then at the end, there's always time for questions. And probably sometime in the middle of the day, at least once, I'll say, anybody have any questions? But it's quite a sort of traditional format Theravada retreat. Nothing, I'll ask you to stay in silence the whole time, other than if you're asking a question, because I've asked you to ask a question. But other than that, everybody stays in silence except me. I yak a lot. That's one of the advantages of being the teacher. Does that answer your question?
It does, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, so sitting periods are typically about half an hour. Typically there's six or seven sitting periods, so four or five walking periods, and then some time in between where I'm talking. And so it's about 75% practice and 25% me teaching and talking.
Gotcha. Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, good. Yeah. Bye, everybody. See you all again soon.
Thanks, Barry.